So continuing on with our fish studies, we're going to start, first talk on that topic is called Fish Presence and Abundance, and that will be given by Mary Louise Keefe. Mary Louise Keefe received her PhD from the University of Rhode Island studying chemically mediated behavior in native populations of brook trout. She relocated to the Pacific Northwest in 1991 and spent the next 8 years working on life history, habitat use, and migration of Snake River, Spring Chinook salmon, and steelhead. For the past 12 years, she's been working as a private consultant and has worked on a variety of salmonid population, passage, and habitat projects throughout the western United States. Dr. Keefe has been leading the fisheries resource baseline studies on the Pebble Project since 2008 and is here today to talk to us about those efforts. This is a really big program. It's involved a lot of field work, which you're going to hear about from Mary Lou. And then after that, we'll have Dudley Reiser, also from R2, talk about fish habitat. Again, there's a lot of information. Our schedule might be adjusted a little bit because we want to take all the time that we need to hear about their studies and also give lots of time for questions and answers and comments. So let's welcome Mary Lou.
So there were a lot of people involved in the fish resource studies from 2004 through 2008, and the first thing I want to do is acknowledge those folks, including staff from HDR, APS Services, R2, and Dana Stewart helped out quite a bit with the databases and getting all that, I mean, thousands and thousands of data points together in a format that will be queryable and allowed us to do analyses. I guess I want to make a couple of points before I really jump into the talk. And one is there's a chapter in the EBD devoted to fish resources at the mine site, and another two along the representative road alignment. These are summary chapters because we have an abundance of data that you can't possibly put into a document. So in addition to these summary chapters, there's an appendix that is available that really just lays the data out there, maps, graphs, tables, and that appendix, for those of you who, maybe I'm too close to this, for those of you who really want to dig into the data, you'll have an opportunity to do that in the appendix B. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Today I'm going to cover fish habitat and population from the field effort that we put together. I'm also going to talk about a radio telemetry study that was conducted as a part of the baseline studies, and then I'm going to hit on the surveys that were conducted for representative road alignment. And now I'll jump in, I think. Over the course of the study period, there were about 15 different studies that were undertaken associated with fish. There were habitat studies that were conducted in the main stem and the tributaries. There were fish assemblage studies, and there were in-stream flow specific, really focused studies that Dudley's going to talk about later. This graph gives you an overview of where and when those studies were conducted. Oops, sorry about that. It's intuitively not, now I got it. This is the mine study area, and what I want to really focus you in on is, because it's such a large area, and we collected so much data for the fish resources, we came up with this concept of breaking the streams up into reaches. So that these are the reach delineations. They start with A being the lowest most reach, or the downstream most reach in the watershed, going up to E at the top, or F or G, depending on how many reaches we broke up. The reaches were delineated by geomorphology, hydrology, and ecology as we knew it at the time. And the appendix B that I mentioned to you is broken up. The data is broken up into these reaches so that you can see habitat data by reach, fish data by reach. Okay, first objective. In the habitat studies, the first thing we wanted to do is characterize these channels. What's the morphology and the valley form of the channels that are out there? These are very uniform channels, flat, broad, single thread for the most part. As you've heard over the past couple of days, large glacial influence. There are high flow events that routinely overtop the banks here and engage wetland and off-channel habitats in the floodplain. Some photos to help orient you to the kind of habitat that's out there, starting with NFKA, low gradient, big, wide, broad river, stays pretty wide and open all the way up till around this corner at NFKE. Get a little smaller channel up here. Overall, the gradient in the NFK is less than 1% on average. South Fork, very similar. I want to orient you to one thing as we're talking. This is SFKC. This is the reach where there's that ephemeral flow drying that happens in the middle of the South Fork, and then the flow transfer down to tributary 190 in the UT. And then some pictures for Upper Tularet Creek. Upper Tularet Creek was a little bit steeper than the Coquetilies. It has a gradient averaging somewhere between 2 and 3%. It also has a little more complexity in the bottom. It has braided channel, multiple thread morphology down there as opposed to the Coquetilies. Now we know what the channels are like. We needed to go in and look at the habitats that were there. How many pools, riffles, glides did we have? We used two approaches for this. The first one was a field approach. We used standard surveys from the U.S. Forest Service Aquatic Inventory Protocol. We had some modifications because these surveys are generally pedestrian surveys to be conducted by foot during low flow conditions. We conducted them by foot where we could, but for example, in the lower Tularet, it was essential to use a boat and we couldn't collect all of the parameters that were appropriate for pedestrian surveys. So there are modifications to those. Surveys were conducted continuously. We started at the bottom of a reach and we went to the top. We also approached habitat mapping with remote data. So we had aerial imagery and we used GIS to determine where the pools were and estimate area associated with pools, riffles, and glides throughout the watersheds. I think it's just slow. I want it to be faster. Sorry. So what did we find? A lot of fast water habitat, not surprisingly. The red and the blue are, blue is run or glide, red is riffle. As you can see, through NFK A, B, and C, we have almost exclusively fast water habitat, tiny slivers of pool habitat at about 1 and 2%. We get up here at NFK D, we start seeing a little more pool habitat. This is also where we have some main stem beaver activity going, and the pool that we see up here is really associated with beaver ponds. Around the corner here in NFKE, much more pool habitat associated with beaver ponds, and a tiny sliver, about 2% of non-beaver pool habitat. Similar picture in the SFK, a little tiny bit more non-beaver pool habitat in the lower two reaches, and not quite as strong an effect of the beaver in the main stem, but a pretty similar picture. A lot of fast water habitat, not a lot of pool habitat in these main stems And here we have the UT. UT has non-beaver pool habitat in every reach, very small in the lower larger sections. But we start getting up close to 10% here in the middle, UTC, and it increases from there, except when we get to the top, which is the steeper gradients, very small channel. The other thing that's noticeable about the UT is the pool habitat in the UT is main stem is not necessarily beaver dam associated. There's a little bit of that going on in UTF, but not quite the extent that you see in the Coquetilies. A third objective of the habitat surveys was to go through and document some special habitat features. We know there are a lot of seeps and springs out there. Where are they located specifically with respect to habitats? Where are these beaver ponds? Are there intermittent flow reaches beyond this large reach we know about in the main stem SFK? Lakes, ponds, tributary confluences, things that are important to fish. We also looked at barriers as we went through our surveys. In the NFK, you've heard this, so I'm going to go pretty quickly through these. Several groundwater upwelling areas in the lower reaches. We did find some intermittent flow in tributary 1.19010. Beaver ponds were limited in the main stem, yet abundant in off-channel areas. And then there's this big wiggly lake that's up top of the middle of NFK, and that supports a small lake spawning population of sockeye. SFK, intermittent flow, and then that tributary discharge down to UT1.190 that we talked about. Beaver ponds, again, upstream of Frying Pan Lake and in off-channel areas. The SFK is a little bit different in that some of the upper reaches, there are quite a number of small ponds and small lakes. And there are two large lakes utilized by fish in the system, Frying Pan Lake, big flat lake, in SFKE reach, and then Chiquita Lake downstream. UT differences, and we heard this yesterday, groundwater throughout the UT, pretty much in all of the reaches. Tributary 1190 gets steady cross basin flow. Beaver ponds are scarce in the main stem. Lakes and ponds are prevalent along the tributaries on the eastern edge of this watershed. And some of these lakes and ponds support spawning salmon. Okay, now we get into some more detail on what are the quantity and types of off-channel habitats. There were four areas of off-channel, high concentration of off-channel habitat that were surveyed over the course of the study. One of those in North Fork, one in South Fork, and two in Upper Tulare Creek. This is the area in the North Fork that was surveyed. It's located right here in the middle of that watershed. There were six types of off-channel habitat that were identified. Beaver ponds, classified beaver pond outlet channels as a different type, alcove, isolated pools. Side channels were classified as off-channel in these watersheds because they just don't occur that much, and percolation channels. And what we find when we go to the off-channel is it's largely beaver pond-driven off-channel habitat. All of the other habitats are represented, but 85% of what we surveyed was associated with beaver. Similar situation in the South Fork. Again, we're in the middle. We're below the dry area here, but we're in the middle of the South Fork. 91% beaver, all others were represented, however. UT, two sections of off-channel habitat from the middle, 93% associated with beaver activity. So clearly the beaver in these watersheds are impounding water in these off-channel areas and providing a large amount of a slow slack water habitat. Help me, Ben. All right, now I'm going to go forward. That's it for the habitat, and so I'm going to move on to objective five, which starts with the fish assemblage data. So we surveyed specifically 2,898 distinct locations throughout the 5 years of baseline studies, and it was approximately equally proportioned across the three basins. Primary survey methods were snorkeling and electrofishing. Electrofishing was limited when there were adults, salmon in the system, and sometimes habitats weren't conducive to either snorkeling or electrofishing, such as beaver ponds. So we used minnow trapping, seining, tangle netting, angling, and in some instances when there were just thousands of fry, dip netting. These surveys were focused on freshwater stages and resident freshwater fishes. All species were identified to the best of the ability of the crews, the exception of a couple of whitefish that were really hard to figure out, and sometimes sticklebacks. And the life stage was identified, juvenile, adult. Fork length was measured on a subset of fish or estimated for snorkeling. The goal was to document fish presence everywhere we surveyed. In some cases, where we were able to get good numbers, we got fish abundances that would allow us to compare across sites. And then there were attempts made at winter sampling. They were not very successful at winter sampling. The logistical constraints and safety issues associated with breaking up ice and snorkeling proved to be too much given the few fish that they were able to see under those conditions. So the first thing we're going to take a look at is the anadromous fish distribution. The yellow line that runs through the middle of the reaches here is the anadromous waters catalog, a delineation of anadromous waters from 2009. It goes up the tributaries as well. The purple areas are the areas that the data collected during baseline studies. They're areas where we extended the anadromous waters catalog, and these tributaries up here at the top of the North Fork. And then these red dots that you can see throughout are areas where surveys were conducted and no anadromous fish were present at the time of the survey. In the North Fork, there were a dozen species that were documented. The reach with the most species richness was NFKC. The numbers tended to decrease once we got up around that corner in the smaller channel in NFKE and F. And there were some species, Chinook, Coho, Dolly, and Sculpin, that were pretty much found everywhere we looked. Species composition was generated by taking all of the data that was collected in these reaches, putting it together and giving you a picture in this graph of what was found. The things that are going to help you from now on in the study are remembering that the anadromous salmonids are the primary colors, and the resident species tend to be more in the pastels. So you start down low in NFKA, largely dominated by Chinook and Coho, a couple of other little residents tucked in there, but less than one, or about 1%. You move up the system, similar picture in NFKB. NFKC, you start seeing some resident species, Dolly and Sculpin, show up. By NFKD, we've lost most of the Chinook here. We've got Coho, Arctic Grayling, Sculpin, Dolly Varden, some Northern Pike, and some Stickleback. NFKE, we're around that corner now. We have a little bit of a different habitat up here. This is dominated by Dolly Varden. We still see Coho and Sculpin. And at the top, it's mostly Sculpin, but there's a little sliver of Chinook salmon up there. And Dollies. Relative fish abundance at these sites, then. That's the overall composition. How many fish were we seeing? This is relative abundance is analyzed as fish per 100 meters of stream. Generally, anadromous fish downstream, resident fish upstream. Let's take a look at the numbers. not a huge amount of Chinook in NFKA, but pretty good numbers of coho, 500 per 100 meter square is pretty decent. Very few, as you would expect, chum and sockeye. Similar picture in NFKB, although you see more Chinook up here. NFKC, you start to get representation of the resident fishes, but they're all pretty low, below 50 fish per 100 meters, and the coho are at some of their highest numbers up here in NFKC at over 1,500 fish per meter, 100 meters. Now to the SFK, nadimus distribution, all the way up to here, sampling above, and in tributaries where we didn't find a nadimus fish and the extension of that distribution in a couple of tributaries. 14 species found in the greatest species richness in SFKB. SFK is interesting because there's a real shift in the fish assemblage above and below that ephemeral reach, not surprising for migratory fishes, but it shows up pretty well in the data. And then you do see coho, grayling, and dolly, and sculpin throughout. Looking a little bit closer at all the data that was compiled, what's the composition? Again, similar to the North Fork, we have coho and Chinook dominating the lower two reaches, although in SFKB, we have quite a bit of variety. This is that spring habitat at the top of this, that where the recharge comes from the drying reach in the SFK, and the fish are clearly taking advantage of that. Upstream, we move into Arctic grayling habitat. We still have some coho in SFK C and D, but it's largely resident fish dominated. Northern pike show up in SFKD, Frying Pan Lake, and SFKE. Again, similar picture to before, primary colors indicating mostly anadromous fish lower in the system and residents above. Let's take a look at some of the numbers. Pretty high relative abundance here in the SFKA. 500 to 600 Chinook and coho per 100 meters. Nice little chunk of dollies down there too at about 50. This is a very sensitive mouse. SFKB, same thing going on. See a couple more species showing up, but relatively low abundance. SFKC, we start seeing some sculpin, stickleback, northern pike, but very low abundances for those species that are just showing up here. And overall, a reduction in relative abundance. We're down here, the scale is not up in the 500 anymore, it's around 50 fish per 100 meters. SFKD, this is that spot where the Arctic grayling are so prominent, and we can see we're seeing good numbers of them, 275 per 100 meters. Similar situation, reduced numbers, lots of fish, but reduced densities in E, and that's it. Let's go through the UT, anadromous fish distribution, areas that were extended in purple, and red dots, areas where we did sample but weren't able to find any anadromous fish. 13 species. Greatest abundance of species show up here in the middle reaches of the UT, UTC, D, and E. The community is also relatively consistent across the UT. There doesn't seem to be as big of a shift in resident anadromous assemblage. And an interesting comment I want to make on this pink salmon line here is in two of the early years of the study, there were small groups of pink salmon that were observed during aerial surveys. These fish were seen in these groups one time in 2 years and never again. So we're just assuming this was some kind of exploratory thing going on with the pinks. The surveys were conducted every year, they just never were seen. And with increased frequency, as I'll mention later. UT is a little different than the other pattern than the others in that down here in UTA, you really have a lot of more lake-type habitat, and you see that with the stickleback showing up. The other thing that I want to mention is you have good big pie pieces of rainbow trout in these two lower reaches. And it's a little bit of an artifact here because one of the studies that I'll talk about later targeted collecting rainbow trout for radio telemetry because there are large rainbow trout in this system. So the effort was to target these fish in this lower reach so we could sample them. But otherwise, you know, fast water, coho, chinook dominated, up through the middle reaches where C and D, where you start seeing some Arctic grayling coming in and some sculpin, stickleback. And then when you get up to the top, it's dominated by sculpin, some dollies. You still have some coho up in the top at UTG. Let's go through the relative abundance. Unlike the other two systems, where there are a lot of primary colors down here and a lot of pastels, you can see there's more mixing going on. Numbers are pretty good here. Look at this Arctic grayling bar, about somewhere up close to 2,800 fish per 100 meter in those sampling locations. You've got coho over 700 and 200-300 chinook. Numbers stay high as we start moving up the system. Got some small abundances of resident fish showing up. Numbers start to drop around UTE, but they're still pretty good at, you know, 750 coho per 100 meters. We get up to UTG. We see the coho drop off dramatically down to about 30. We see the sculpin take off. Still, overall numbers are much lower this high in the system. We also did a limited number of surveys, conducted a limited number of surveys in the upper reach of the Coquitlam River main stem. 10 species were identified there, all of which were found in the North and South Fork Coquitlam. And we didn't spend a lot of time down there because it's not anticipated there'll be a lot of change as things move forward. But we do know that the Coquitlam River serves as a migratory corridor for the fish that are moving up into the Coquitlam River. Here's the species composition, largely chinook, coho, sockeye. All right, now we're going to go one step further, and we're going to try and look at fish density, so the number of fish per meter squared. And this allows us to compare across habitat types, so a small channel with a larger channel, off-channel habitat, and main stem habitat. These are the data for the North Fork. Starting in the middle of the North Fork, we can see that coho are pretty much dominating the habitats, highest in the backwater, but also highest in all other habitat types. In the off-channel habitat in the North Fork, it's coho again at 225 or 230 fish per 100 meters squared. They're much higher than the next most dense, which is stickleback at 25. In the SFK, upper reach, densities are much lower, dominated by dollies and Arctic grayling. And really, you know, not too much. I guess, you know, the dollies look like they like the backwater, but not necessarily the pools. Arctic grayling dominate the other three habitat types. There are some rainbow showing up in pool and riffle habitat. Off-channel habitats in the SFK, again, dominated by coho. This is about 35 fish per 100 meter squared for coho. You see some chinook in the side channel, not surprising. And these numbers of residents, the scale is different, you know, 1.4, really low densities in off-channel habitat. Lastly, UT. UTC, pretty low numbers here compared to what we saw, and dominated by Arctic grayling in the run habitat. Coho, good numbers in both. Chinook, okay, in the fast water. We go upstream. Again, there's largely fast water habitat. We move into coho. Not terribly high densities compared to the ones we saw over in the Coquitlam. And coho dominated up in UTF as well. UTG is where we see the switch. Coho numbers drop down, densities drop down, sculpin pick up. And you've got just a little blip of Dolly-Varden. Off channels, same story we've been seeing in the other systems, dominated by coho, a couple of little peaks for other fish, and you do also see stickleback and some grayling in the off-channel habitat, sculpin. Okay, so we've talked about freshwater fish, freshwater life stages. Now let's get to the fun stuff and let's talk about the adult salmon. Drive these systems quite a bit. So objective 7 was to document the distribution and abundance of anadromous salmon that are spawning in these systems. Aerial surveys were conducted to accomplish this. They were conducted every year starting in 2004 through 2008. Different numbers of surveys were conducted in different years, and generally we improved the methodology to try and make sure that we were capturing the extent of time that fish would be residing in the system, and improve the survey counts. In addition, in 2009, and I'm not going to talk about this data today, but I did want to mention that in 2009, a tower count study was conducted, and the graduate student from the University of Washington has put together a thesis on this, and I'm sure there's going to be a publication coming out about that. So overall spawning distribution in the North Fork, heavily weighted towards the bottom of the system. Sockeye most abundant in A and dropped down to D. Chinook only found in A, B, and C. Chum only in A, B, and C, although Chinook seemed to prefer the A to C and chum are the other way. And then coho spawned from reach A up through reach E. So that's up to here. In the South Fork, spawning distribution is really limited to SFK A and B. In years when we don't lose that intermittent reach, you get a couple of stragglers that get up into the bottom of SFK C here. And there were 8 and 1 fish observed there as a mean for those in 2008. And in the UT, we have to separate the graphs out because the order of magnitude for sockeye is so much greater than the other species. So you can see that coho are pretty much ubiquitous, spawning from A to F, tiny little blip in G. They really have a strong preference for these middle reaches, D, E, and F. Chinook in very low numbers throughout A through F, and chum also throughout A through F. Sockeye, highest numbers, lowest in the system, and decline precipitously up through a couple left by the time you get up here at UTF. Overall, estimates across years, how did these numbers change? We have some mean index counts to compare. In the north, so this is Chinook salmon, and we're going to go North Fork, South Fork, Upper Tularuk. Chinook seemed to have been doing pretty well early on in 2004, 2005 in all three systems, and have suffered a decline and have been relatively steady and low since then, dropping from about 1,800 in the North Fork to less than 500 and now are about 200. South Fork, the numbers are similar, about 2,000. Down to about 750, and then down around the 200. UT, the numbers are much less, lower numbers of Chinook over there. In the good year, it was about 175, 200, down to about 50 subsequent years. In the coho, I don't really see much of a pattern here, but generally coho are somewhere between 150 and 500 fish in the North Fork, somewhere between 150 and 500 fish in the South Fork, and much bigger numbers in the Upper Tularik, from 1,000 to 4,000 in 2006. Chum in the Coquitlam's, pretty good numbers, 150 to 500, both of those systems hardly show up at all in the UT. We've got mean index counts of 12 and 17, and then the low of 5. Sockeye. In the Coquitlam's, we have a pretty consistent pattern for sockeye. They seem to be hovering right around 500, 600 fish in the North Fork. Somewhere between 1,000 and 1,800 fish in the South Fork. In the UT, things are dramatically different. You have an order of magnitude greater abundance of sockeye over there. In 2004, the mean index count was 30,000. That dropped in 2005 and stayed relatively low, somewhere between a couple thousand and 10,000 fish from 2005 through 2008. One of the things to mention about the UT was that in 2008, as we started, this whole reach concept was up and going before we went out in the field. And as we did the adult salmon counts in 2008, we had GPS units with us and we were marking the locations of the reaches so we could put the fish counts within those reaches and look at distribution across the whole watershed. And one of the things we noticed was that there were a large number of fish going up the tributary, the first tributary in the UT, which is called Otter Creek, First Creek, or UT 1.60 in the nomenclature of the EBD. So we did surveys continually throughout the season in UT 160 to get a handle on how many fish might be going up there. And that's what these graphs represent. This is coho, this first graph here. This is the data from the mean index count from 2008 for coho in the entire UT except UT 160. And that's just a little over 1,500. Where we saw about 300 coho going up into UT 1.60. So it turns out to be about 17% of that run that year. Here's a sockeye down here. So for all of the system except UT 160, we're at about 11,000. And for UT 160, we're at about 8,000. So about 40% in 2008 that went up one. About 160. Okay, I'm going to take a sip of water if you don't mind. Switching gears. This is a specific study that was done in 2007 and 2008 because it was noticed during the early baseline studies that there were these big rainbow trout in Upper Tularik Creek. And rainbow trout are an important sport fishery, especially in this drainage. So two groups of fish were tagged. There was a group of what were considered foraging fish that were tagged in the summer in August in 2007. And then later, the next spring, there were a group of post-spawners that were tagged. And these fish were tracked both with fixed stations at the bottom of Upper Tularik Creek and at the bottom of Lower Tularik Creek, as well as through mobile surveys. The mobile surveys varied from once a week in the summer to once a month in the winter, depending on how much activity we were seeing and what kind of conditions were out there. This is the survey area covered by mobile surveys. So they flew up these, up or down, these major tributaries, not down here, but the tributaries and the drainage associated with Iliamna Lake. They also flew transects across the lake when it was, when they could, when weather permitted. Overall, the distribution of detections, you can see, is pretty much everywhere on this western portion of Iliamna Lake, including many of the tributaries. A couple of fish do go up here, but most of it was concentrated here. This is the overall distribution, and I'm not going to show you all the slides we have for this because it would take me another 20 minutes, but this also represents what we call the foraging distribution, so the distribution of detections during the foraging period. They did not, however, overwinter everywhere. Overwintering, although we had fewer detections during that time, we also, it was limited to Lower Tulare Creek. I believe this is Pete Andrews or Zuhair. This is the New Halen, and we can see down here in the Kwichak. They moved around quite a bit, these fish did. They visited individuals from 1 to 5 different water bodies, 1 to 16 times, and they went anywhere from a mile away from the point of release to 90 kilometers. Here's an example of a fish track. So we would go out on this date, and then we'd go out the next time, and we'd see the star is the release date. We'd fly the first survey, the fish was here, and it was here, stayed here for a little bit, moved down, down, down. And so these are, you know, assumed migratory routes. Of course, we don't have any idea what the fish did in 7 days from here to here. But it does show a relative direction of movement. So when we tagged these fish and we looked at and we analyzed the data, we found that there were two behavioral patterns, big picture patterns that were seen. One was fish that were tagged in the UT, left the UT, and came back to the UT at some point in time. The other was fish that were tagged in the UT, left to the UT, and never returned. And these behavioral patterns were independent of whether they were summer-tagged foraging fish or post-spawning fish. I'm going to just show you a couple of slides that talk about those groups. And it's this first slide is a way to capture residence time for these fish in the UT versus the other water bodies that they visited. So we took detection days, and we summed detection days by these water bodies, and we averaged them for the group. And this is a percent of those detection days. So for the summer tag group that left the UT and came back, 14% of their time was spent in the UT, as opposed to 39% in Lower Tularik and 32% in the lake and other tributaries. The spring group, it's same return to the UT, only 5% of their time spent in the UT, quite a bit of time spent in the lake and other tributary streams. For those fish that never came back to the UT, we saw them, tagged them, and they never returned. They actually spent 20% and 13% of their time in the UT, quite a bit for the summer group. Summer group really, fish really like the Lower Tularik, according to this analysis anyway. And then, you know, quite a bit of time, majority of time for both of these fish in the lake and other streams. And we looked at site fidelity, specifically with respect to spawning and foraging in these fish. How many repeaters did we see? For spawning, we had 53 fish. Of course, these fish were tagged in the UT, so of course, they spawned one time in the UT. We only had 7 repeat spawners, and 3 of those fish that were tagged in the UT after spawning showed up during the spawning period in other tributaries. Foraging, we had 67 fish tagged, 52 foraged in the UT one time, 9 fish repeated, came back a second time to forage in the UT. 67 of them went to other tributaries to forage at least one time, and 13 of them repeat foraging incursions into Lower Tularik Creek. And that's all I'm going to do. There'll be a report coming out on the radio tracking later. It's not included in the EBD. It came up afterwards, but we presented this information at Alaska AFS, so we thought we'd share it with you. Okay, if I have time, I'm going to jump to the road, representative road alignment and surveys that we conducted associated with that. These surveys were conducted from 2005 through 2008, and the primary objectives were to characterize channel conditions, what types of aquatic habitats were present, what were the water quality characteristics, and what was the composition and distribution of fishes. As Charlotte mentioned on day one, I think, there were many possible road alignments that have been discussed. So the object here wasn't to go to a specific location and see if there were fish there or not. It was to go to all the potential stream crossings that could be crossed, I guess, by this potential road, and characterize what we could find there. If we went to a location that was identified on a map as a stream crossing, and there wasn't a stream there, or there was a channel, but there was no water, we moved up and down a little bit to capture, is there running water around here upstream? Is there a stream nearby? So we did move around and tried to capture all of that. What that resulted in was this concept of primary and support survey sites. Primary sites being sites that would most likely be crossings, and then support sites where we had to go upstream or downstream quite a distance before we could find water and survey. So here's a representative road alignment with all these primary and support sites. In the Bristol Bay portion, the circles are the primary sites and the diamonds are the support sites. For ease of description in the EBD, we kind of clumped these into similar watershed groups, and they're discussed in that way. Here's the Cook Inlet sites down here. Fish presence, so I know these dots are hard to see. I'm sorry, it's a big area. Anadromous fish are the blue dots. That shows anadromous fish presence at these sites, and red dots are resident fish. Black diamonds are no fish present. And again, only one resident fish and one anadromous fish site in the Cook Inlet crossings. Water quality, we surveyed habitat and water quality at all of these potential sites, and we did see a number of criteria for baseline water quality conditions that would be, did not meet the standard for aquatic life, and those are mapped here. pH are the most obvious green circles. Those are sites where the pH did not meet criteria. The red and black are, I'm going to have to use my glasses. Temperature criteria not met, and the orange is dissolved oxygen criteria not met. So quite a few sites where existing conditions are different than what the criteria might like to see. And just one site over here in Cook Inlet with a temperature criteria not being met. And that's all I have for you. Any questions?
Ted Otis, Department of Fish and Game. Questions about the adult salmon surveys that you did. It sounds like it was mainly aerial surveys that you used?
Yes, except in 2009 when the towers were placed in Upper Tulare Creek.
Right, so how did you turn the periodic survey counts into a total season index of escapement?
We indexed the counts. The number of surveys conducted each year was variable. Fewer surveys were conducted in 2004. They tend to span the runs, but there were fewer surveys conducted in 2004, more in 2005. Finally, in 2008, I think we were up to 26. So we were at a tighter window, survey window, 5 days. And unfortunately, with that not balanced design, and also attempts were made at getting observer efficiencies and resident life data. There were several attempts made at collecting those data over the years, and they weren't successful at coming up with good, rigorous numbers. So we didn't go with a total escapement estimate using an area under the curve. The data weren't, got together and talked with Brian Bew, and we looked at the numbers, and they just weren't going to work very well. So what we did was we went to the literature and actually found this method of mean index counts, which is documented in a paper by Holt and Cox from 2008. And what they say is that when you have that kind of variability in your design, that you can your mean index count will be as rigorous as an area estimated under the curve because you don't have tight confidence around your observer efficiency. So it's just a way for us to compare. It's not intended to be a total escapement count. It's a way for us to compare across years and across the distributions.
Right, and given how rough an index that is, as you described, I know there's been a lot of discussion in the past about using alternative methods, whether they be weirs or video, et cetera. Is there any plans to use something that's more of a census and gives you an absolute abundance estimate?
Well, I can't speak to the plans for the future of Pebble, but we did try towers in Upper Tulare Creek, and I don't want to burst Ben Nelson's bubble, but didn't work very well. There was too much back and forth motion for the towers to generate good strong counts in these smaller systems. And as they move forward, I'm sure that they'll be considering all sorts of new monitoring methods.
And then if I could, just one quick question, that what you guys are calling the Y Valley Creek, what I think you said you found one anadromous species in there. What did you find and how many?
I would have to actually go to the database and look, but I can get you that answer before I leave today.
Oh, I can probably find it in your baseline document too.
I'm having a hard time hearing you, I'm sorry.
I can look it up in your baseline document too. I just hadn't gotten through it that far, so okay. Thanks.
Other questions? Just one. Thank you.
Yeah, hi, Mike Daniel with Fish and Game. I just had a few questions for clarity. So the rainbow trout telemetry stuff, you had a graph up there, or the table, about the time spent in different areas. And one of the groups was not returned to the UT, but then it represented some time spent in the UT, and I was just confused how that could happen.
So fish were tagged and released in the UT. So it could have stayed in the UT for 3 days, 5 days. We had one fish that stayed in the UT for over 250 days before it left.
So you were monitoring that residence time then before they left the UT is what you're
saying? Yes.
Okay. And then your other series of graphs, either be it distribution, the relative abundance, and fish density, I wasn't clear, did that include adults, juveniles, or both? I wasn't clear what those numbers represented.
They're largely juveniles and freshwater fishes. If an adult, they include adult resident fishes, and there are very few data. If an adult anadromous fish was observed during some event, we tried to remove those and just have the juveniles, but there are some cases where life stages weren't documented, so there may be very small numbers, less than 1% of the data, that would be adult fish. For example, there were some sockeye bars in the UT in one of those graphs, and there are adult sockeye that were included in those bars.
Okay, but so you're saying for the most part it was juvenile anadromous fish, and then it could have been any life stage of resident fish, but that's, we can't tease that out with what you've got on those.
You can't tease it out from the summary graphs, no. You can see it in the data.
And have you done that in your own analysis, just
no.
Separately?
Okay. We have not separated it out. There are tables, Mike, just with respect to that, there is a table of fish observations in Appendix B by reach, and it lists the life stage and the number of fish observed, and I believe the method as well. So you can, it is in that, it's just not analyzed in any way for you.
Harry Karshikov from Dundalton. I was just asking about
Could you please talk a little bit louder? It's just kind of hard to hear.
Harry Karshikov from Dundalton. I'm just asking about mountain trout and freshwater herring. We got that around Dundalton. They fish it in the springtime and fall time.
I'm sorry. I really need to hear
about
the question again.
Mountain trout and freshwater herring.
Okay, the first one is mountain trout and then freshwater herring.
Yes.
What he's asking about.
We do have data on whitefish, which I believe are mountain trout. And are you talking about Cisco for freshwater herring?
They call it mountain trout. I don't know if it's Arctic grayling or what.
We did have Arctic grayling represented in our data and in the EBD.
Is that same as mountain trout?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Bobby Andrew with Equoc Tribal Council. My question is, in some of the spawning areas where the cohorts were more frequently spawning, were they located in groundwater fed areas?
Thank you so much, because I got really excited yesterday when Hugh was up here and he was showing those longitudinal graphs of the arrows going down, so where the groundwater was going down and where the groundwater was coming up. And I really wish I had a whole time and Excel files so we could have pulled together and shown. It would have to happen in 2008 when we did GPS the fish observations. But yes, in general, the patterns are identical. Where you see the fish spawning are where we have those groundwater surcharges happening in the river, almost to a T. Okay, thank you. I'm not off yet.
Sorry, I thought of one other thing. In your adult anadromous stuff, I know you said there was, for the most part, for coho and chum, it looked, for the most part, stable through the years, but 2006, 2008 looked high for both of those species, and I was wondering if you had any observations or insight to that, why those were better years for those fish.
I don't really have a lot of insight. There is a graph in the EBD that that combines those numbers with overall escapement estimates from ADFG, and there were some trends that made sense when you look at overall escapement numbers and years. I don't know them off the top of my head, but it's in there. You can take a look at that. Some of them made sense, and some of them just didn't.
Yeah, Matt Miller with Fish and Game. Can you clarify a little bit what the sampling schedule was like in these different systems? You guys obviously covered a lot of area, had a lot of sites and a lot of species, but were your crews, for example, starting in one system down at the, at the mouth and working their way up and then going to the next system, or were they, you've got lots of tables and graphs about the relative abundance, but I don't know what that means if I don't know what time of year they were up there seeing these fish, even if you're talking about juveniles.
Most of the sampling that you saw for the distribution and abundance of fishes was conducted between July and October, when we could actually get into the river and walk around and do things. We had multiple crews up in multiple places at multiple times. We didn't have a crew of four that started here and went and covered this area and then moved on. There were main stem surveys going on at the same time that there were tributary surveys. There were habitat surveys that were going on at the same time. There were fish assemblage crews following them behind.
And that differed from year to year?
And they differed from year to year.
More questions? Okay.
Sorry. Dan Young, National Park Service. You mentioned something about the road corridor and all stream crossings, the goal being to get a understanding of fish and water quality on all stream crossings.
Habitat as well.
And habitat as well. If you look at your figure, obviously that doesn't cover all the stream crossings. So I was wondering if you have an idea of how many stream crossings there are and how many you sampled of those.
Most of them. What happened in from 2004 to 2005 to 2008, there were a little bit of complications with access. So there was a chunk that wasn't able to be surveyed at that time and isn't included in the EBD. It was surveyed subsequently. So I'd say, and Jim's probably got the number in his head because he's the one who was out there on the ground saying, you need to go here, you need to go here, and created this map and told our crews where they need to go. But I'd say we covered all but maybe five potential stream crossings.
Thank you.
Jim, can you, I know you know the number of stream crossings.
Well, Dan, I don't have the exact number in my head, but I can certainly get it during lunch. Handful, 5-6 streams on the corridor had access problems, and we didn't cover them. But nearly all of the road crossings were covered, and the only ones that were missed were very small, typically, and may have some resident fish in them. Were very likely not anadromous. But I can go over that with you if you'd like. There are a couple of very, very small streams over near the mine site that weren't covered, but those are ephemeral, and so we got very good coverage, I'd say. And certainly the patterns are clear in the data.
Thank you. Any more questions or comments? Okay. Thanks, Mary Lou. Give her a big hand, a lot of information. Before we continue, I wanted to recognize Alaska Peninsula Corporation. They are very, very much involved in the studies that were presented yesterday. They work on the surface water hydrology and surface water quality sampling throughout the entire Upper Telluric drainage and also on the New Halen River. And this year they are taking on part of the groundwater program where they'll be sampling groundwater wells for water quality and also doing our monthly water level measurements. They've been on the project since 2007, and as Mary Lou pointed out today, we had a fish tower on the Upper Telluric in 2009, and Alaska Peninsula Corporation, APCS, was a very big part of establishing that camp and that tower and working with our team on obtaining those fish counts. And today, we didn't the first 2 days, but today we do have Greg Dubois here with us, and he's the manager of Alaska Peninsula Corporation. Greg, just stand up and put a name to the face for the team. I certainly wanted to mention, you know, not everyone here that is working on the project is presenting, but they certainly are a significant part of our program.